March Madness is upon us, and many eyes will be on the NCAA college basketball tournament, including when the Wisconsin Badgers take on American University on Thursday in Milwaukee. We will talk with a guest who says that all of the cash involved in grooming a successful college big-time sports team and the more than $1 billion in TV revenue that is generated is corrupting the mission of higher education. And we'll wonder if you agree or not, and what questions you have. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Tuesday, March 18th. We will talk with the author of The Athletic Trap, How College Sports Corrupted the Academy. And we'll welcome your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Happy to have with us Howard Nixon, a recently retired professor of sociology at Towson University. He is the co-author of several books, including Sport in a Changing World and A Sociology of Sport. His current book is The Athletic Trap, How College Sports Corrupted the Academy. Good morning.
Good morning.
Explain the athletic trap. What's the trap?
Well, basically, it's a set of social and economic and political commitments or obligations that constrain what presidents, trustees, and other institutional leaders can do with their commercialized athletic programs. And it is a trap because it is, once you get into it, it is very difficult to get out of it.
Yeah, and you describe it as the intercollegiate golden triangle. What is that?
The context. Yes. I mean, if we're talking about the most commercialized programs, the source of that commercial success is the Golden Triangle, and that's the combination of big time, and by big time I mean highly commercialized, big time college sports, the sports media, and particularly CBS and ESPN, but there are other media outlets as well, and then private business investors and merchandisers and other people who make money from their investment in sports.
Yeah, and what does this triangle do that's so hurtful to higher education or to academia?
Well, it provides the lure of getting involved in big-time sports, of chasing the money and all the attention that they can get from the major media outlets in particular. And I think basically my argument is, you know, my book is as much about higher education as it is about athletics, and this is, by the way, not a new story. It's since, you know, it's over a century old, but basically it's the idea that all that money and exposure lures schools into trying to become big time. That means investing a lot of money in athletics, and from there, we have all kinds of problems develop, from cheating to the recruitment of underprepared athletes to the diversion of resources to athletics.
Yeah. Well, doesn't a good, successful, big-time sports team also result in prestige and higher enrollment and more alumni contributing to the program, and it leads to money coming in that way?
You've kind of summarized the institutional enhancement rationale that a lot of institutional leaders buy into. However, it's not completely true. It's not true for all that try to play big-time college sports, and it's difficult to sustain those kinds of things. And basically, there are a lot of myths involved in that, too. I mean, people see all the money, and they think, well, my goodness, college athletics obviously is an area where you can make a lot of money. And, in fact, if you take the $120 biggest, approximately 120 biggest programs in football in particular, where relatively more money is than even basketball. Only about less than 20% actually make a profit, and that's actually since we're talking about supposedly nonprofit institutions, they generate a surplus, and all the rest scramble to cover their costs. And especially if you get to the mid-major level, the smaller schools, none of them essentially makes money from college athletics. The way that they balance their budget is on the backs of the students. The mandatory student fee is a crucial factor in enabling athletic programs to compete at a fairly high level. And there are schools that have 80 to 85% of their athletic budget come from mandatory student fees.
Mm-hmm. And again, I'm just asking, what's wrong with that? The kids enjoy going to the games, so maybe their fees should go toward the team.
Well, I mean, there are a few things that are a problem with that. One is that it's mandatory. You don't get to choose. I'm sure that a lot of parents, if given the choice, would rather not hike up their the cost of college, which is high enough as it is. That's another issue. I mean, that is a major concern in higher education today is cost and affordability. And, you know, how many students actually take advantage of the opportunity to watch a game? And by the way, we're talking about watching rather than playing. I mean, very, very few students get to participate in big-time college athletics. And, in fact, what's happened is that in schools, especially the schools that are more pressed financially, they cut back on the number of athletic programs they have so that they can invest more in their big-time programs of mainly football and men's basketball.
Yeah, so we might not have a fencing team because we are...
Right. At my own institution, I mean, we have the bare minimum. We recently cut some more sports. Actually, one of them, because of a political backlash, ended up being restored. But it's really been, it is not about students enjoying physical activity, having the opportunity to compete. It's about watching. And, if you're at an institution with 20, 25,000 students, a fraction of those students actually regularly go to games.
Yeah. What evidence is there that the money is being diverted from the academic mission of universities?
Well, I mean, let's look at one of the arguments that in the institutional enhancement rationale, and that is that athletics generates more alumni support, more donations to the institution. In fact, the evidence shows that most of the money that is generated through athletics is actually diverted to athletics. So, I mean, so the idea that it's helping the entire institution is a myth. And I think that, people say, well, what's wrong with having this entertainment? In fact, Charles Klotfelder, who wrote in his book about college sports, that it's not that there's anything necessarily wrong with universities being in the athletic entertainment business. You can see it as a kind of a public service beyond even the institution. But the fact is that that's not what we're about. We're supposed to primarily be about the education of students. And we, when we're spending more and more, and this has happened in recent years. I mean, institutions, public institutions in particular, have really struggled financially since 2008 and the big crash. And yet at the same time, investment in athletics was increasing. Coaches make much more money, the biggest of big-time coaches, than certainly professors and even presidents of institutions. And Klotfelder's argument was that, well, look, let's be honest about this at least. Put it in your mission statement. Say what it is. Say what role athletics has. And if you look at the mission statements of the vast majority of institutions that compete in big-time athletics, there is nothing said about athletics.
We are talking about college athletics, talking about how the big-time money that goes into big-time college sports has taken the focus off of academics in most universities. We're talking with Howard Nixon. He is the author of The Athletic Trap, How College Sports Corrupted the Academy. And we're welcoming your questions for him and your thoughts on this. Do you think that colleges and universities are more interested in the money that sports brings in instead of educating students? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We'll talk about what should be done about the athletic trap when we return. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Howard Nixon, who is a recently retired professor of sociology at Towson University. And he is the author of The Athletic Trap, How College Sports Corrupted the Academy. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions about this. Do you think that college sports is hurting higher education, or at least all the attention and money that goes into college sports? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. March Madness is upon us. Everybody's filling out their brackets. People are planning on going to this game on Thursday in Milwaukee when the Wisconsin Badgers take on American University. Even coming up after 8 on Your Money this morning, Kevin McKinley will have a segment on March Madness and whether it pays or not to enter the office pool. So we'll be talking March Madness a little bit during On Your Money. I mean, it's everywhere, Howard Nixon. Are you, is there any way to stop it?
Well, there are those of us who tilt at windmills. But I think that, in my ideas for reform in the book, acknowledge that we're not going to get rid of commercialized sports, but we can organize them differently. I think that there are challenges to the way that college athletics is run today, though. In fact, it was just yesterday, you might have read in the newspaper about Jeffrey Kessler's antitrust suit against the NCAA, where he's alleging collusion among the NCAA and various schools, member institutions, and limiting the amount of scholarship money that athletes can earn. And you can say, well, what's wrong with that after they're getting their education paid for? But, you know, what it does, what that view does is kind of overlook the idea that this is a very big commercial enterprise. It's not just the media and the business partners in the Golden Triangle. It's the institutions themselves involved in big money, and are we going to stop that? I don't think we're going to stop that. People love their sports, and that's the thing to remember too, that the people who invest. I mean, if you look at some of the cases of corruption, pick the University of Miami for example, which involved a runaway booster, a guy named Nevin Shapiro, who was a convicted criminal before and was involved in illegal activities. At the time, he was contributing big sums of money to get close to the athletic program at Miami. You think, that just is unseemly. You think of that this is higher education, and what does that have to do with higher education? But we're tempted anyway. We know about these things. Part of the idea of the athletic trap is that college presidents, once they get into this trap, I mean, they basically lose their ability to control athletics. It becomes a juggernaut.
Yeah, so how can they not, can't they just say enough is enough?
They can try. Mm-hmm. Let me give you an example at University of North Carolina, a very fine institution. And they had a president who had spent his career there. He had worked his way up through ranks from professor to department chair, and then to become chancellor or president at the University of North Carolina, Holden Thorpe. And, you know, he did some good things in his tenure there, but the one thing that brought him down was the fact that he could not control athletics. And even at this fine, great academic institution, they had academic cheating and various other kinds of things that involved athletes. And he finally threw up his hands and he said, I can't control this. He was in the trap. He knew he couldn't get out of the trap. He resigned. He went to the Washington University in St. Louis, where he was not likely to have the same kinds of problems.
Yeah. Well, you say that the universities should acknowledge that this is going on and organize differently. How would they organize it differently?
Well, I mean, there's a really great idea. I mean, it's kind of dovetails with my own at the former University of Florida president, and I think he was head of the Louisiana State University system. John Lombardi said, look, you know, let's reorganize and let's turn the most commercialized programs. Well, he was talking about football, and he was talking about how you solve the football mess. Well, you reorganize. You create these university football corporations. I'd say that you could also do the same with men's basketball, university basketball corporations. Make them equivalent to university hospitals, these affiliates of the universities that are basically pretty autonomous but still are tied to the institution. Let them make it on their own, you know, financially. And if they can't make it, then they come back to what I call, actually, in my own model, the new NCAA. That would be organized kind of like Division III, the least commercialized level of college sports today, where they have much lower financial commitments and aspirations, where athletes, I talk about the in this new NCAA where you have the student athlete, which we often refer to, but in, you know, the big time, I call it the super conference realm, you have athlete students, where athletics comes first. Well, you know, I think that for the vast majority of college athletes already, I mean, athletics should, you know, be enjoyed, but being a student needs to be first.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
I think.
So, under this model, if the semi-privatized or privatized the football and basketball programs,
right? They'd be not for profits.
Would the students get paid, or the athletes be paid?
Yes, that's a big part of this. They would get now in Lombardi's model, they would get the equivalent of their scholarships, but then they'd also be able to become free agents, much as in pro sports. And you say, well, what does this have to do with pro sports education? Not in that realm. It really isn't. I mean, I think you can see how difficult it is for an athlete in a big-time sports program to be a genuine student and do all the kinds of things that other students do, get involved in activities. Even, you know, pursuing a pre-med curriculum is a really big problem for an athlete because, you know, coaches don't like it when you miss practice to go to labs, for example. And even on our campus, we have those kinds of issues come up from time to time.
Mm-hmm. So we have just a minute or so before we have a news break. What sorts of reaction have you gotten to this this concept?
Well, let's realize that certainly within the Golden Triangle, nobody's going to, you know, hang on to the grasp. But, you know, from time to time, for example, you hear a coach in a major program say, look, let's be honest. Let's bow to reality and let's start paying these athletes more. The trouble is in the NCAA, if you try to do that and they try to increase the compensation for athletes, the other institutions say, no, we can't pay our athletes anymore. You know, and this is the argument and people like Mike Krzyzewski say, look, let's divide it up. I call it partitioning college sports. There are schools that have very, very different interests in athletics and very, very different capabilities in athletics. Let's divide it up. Now, I know that the aspiring programs don't want to hear that, but that's kind of the essence of my solution.
We will talk more about the problem and the solution with our guest, Howard Nixon. He is the author of The Athletic Trap, How College Sports Corrupted the Academy. And we're talking about what might be better. He proposes spinning off the big-time football and basketball programs, make them semi-private, pay the athletes, and that way, he says, cash won't be diverted from higher education academics to go into college sports. What do you think? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. During this March Madness week, we are talking about how college athletics are corrupting college academics, according to our guest, the author of The Athletic Trap. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 6:37 on this Tuesday, March 18th. Our guest is a sociologist who says a powerful network of athletic, media, and private corporate interests lure college presidents and other university leaders into an athletic arms race with promises of higher prestige, with happier students and alumni, with increased enrollments and more financial contributions. But in the end, he says, it is not in the best interest of higher education. We are examining the problem and the possible solutions, and we're welcoming your reactions and questions and possible reforms. We just heard our guest say that organize college sports differently. Maybe spin off the big-time football and basketball programs, make them quasi-private, and maybe pay the athletes. What do you think of that? Or what would you do differently? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Or maybe you don't think this is a problem. You're just looking forward to the NCAA tournament. We have open lines. I'm a little surprised by that. A lot of times we get a lot of reaction when we talk about the influence of big-time or college sports on colleges. Everything okay as far as you're concerned or not? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest, as I mentioned, is a recently retired professor of sociology at Towson University. Howard Nixon is the co-author of several books, including Sport in a Changing World and A Sociology of Sport. His most recent book is The Athletic Trap, How College Sports Corrupted the Academy. And he is based in Baltimore, Maryland. So, Howard Nixon, let's talk a little bit more about this trap and why it is so hard for university presidents or university leaders to get out of this trap.
Well, I think that the problem is that there is a lot of money and power supporting athletics. I mean, I have no illusions that people are going to jump at the opportunity to change something they love. And we have to remember, too, that an awful lot of the people who provide the big money don't really know that much about, don't care that much about the kind of education that happens on the campuses where their favorite sports programs are. I think, though, that college presidents get stuck in this because they have either they've come on board at an institution that's already where the institutional leaders have already been in the trap, and it's very hard to extricate themselves, or they buy into this idea of the institutional enhancements that can come from athletics. Well, I mean, if you go back to the latter part of the 19th century and to places like Harvard, I mean, we don't think of Harvard as big time athletic factory, but in fact, the biggest of the big-time programs were at places like Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Chicago. And the Harvard president from 1869 to 1909 Charles W. Eliot was very outspoken in his criticism of athletics on his own campus, and he couldn't get rid of it because his trustees kept voting against him. Mm-hmm. You know, the trustees and the presidents are supposed to run the university. I mean, they're supposed to have control. And again, this lure of the Golden Triangle, which was really in its nascent stage at the end of the 19th century, was already having its impact. People love their college sports, and it's very difficult to turn the, as I said, turn the juggernaut around, to diffuse it. Because of the love of sports and the money behind it. And, you know, look, if you have a donor who wants to have a big-time program, how do you turn that down? I mean, schools are desperate for money. And they kind of college residents forget, well, wait a minute, that money is actually going to have strings attached. They're, you know, they want to have access to the program. They want to make sure that you're doing everything you can to lure the best coaches, which means you're willing to pay the money, et cetera. And, you know, turning your back on that is very difficult. You've made obligations, plus you've invested in these expensive coaches, given them long-term contracts. You've built these very expensive facilities, which, by the way, cost a lot of money to maintain as well. You get involved in this arms race, and I talk about that, too. Both the Star Wars arms race, which is the escalating cost of coaches, and the facilities arms race, and there's no end in sight. It's not logic. I mean, you think people are smart enough to understand this, but intelligence is not. You know, there are these kinds of obligations and commitments and pressures that make it very difficult to turn around.
Speaking of the salary of coaches, Laura in Madison is with us. Hello, Laura.
Hi, I'm struck by the infographic that made the rounds last year about 40 out of 50 states, the highest paid public official was either a football or a basketball coach. But it seems to me that that was kind of dismissed because athletic associations were paying most of their salaries. Can you tell me what are athletic associations? Where do they get their money from? Are they there to hide where coaches and where all this money is coming from and going to?
And by the way, before you answer that, I did have producer Robin Cherry look up, because I remember that very infographic, and the highest paid public employee in Wisconsin is basketball coach Bull Ryan. He is the highest paid person in the University of Wisconsin system with a salary of $2.1 million a year. So where does that money come from, and what can you tell us about that, Howard Nixon?
Well, part of it comes from states, and of course states have restrictions on how much they can pay people, you know, how state compensation systems work. But you're able to supplement with money from foundations. Now, what is a foundation in answer to the question? I mean, they exist to basically to boost sports programs, to generate interest, and in particular to generate funding. I mean, these are basically people who are big donors, and they play a relatively independent role. I mean, you can control your coach, supposedly, but you can't control people who are not affiliated with the university, and you end up with sometimes, now I'm not certainly going to besmirch the reputations of everybody, but people who have very shady backgrounds, like this guy Nevin Shapiro at Miami. But the foundations themselves are more organized, and they already act relatively independently of universities, although they're supposed to be working hand in hand with the athletic department, and they make it possible to pay these huge, huge salaries. And people say, well, the money comes from independent sources, so what difference does it make? Well, it makes a big difference, because that means that at least part of your control over these coaches is not in your hands. You're depending on people who are not employees of the university, of the university system, for the resources to be able to support these people. And you create these really perverse kinds of situations where, yes, in our state, too, the three best paid state employees are the football coach, the basketball coach at the University of Maryland, and also the women's basketball coach. And, you know, they get paid more than governors, they get paid more than presidents, they certainly get paid more than professors. And that's a real, I call that a perversion of values. And it's very difficult to control that. I wrote a paper about this with a colleague of mine called the Star Wars Arms Race, where we just are in this competition to pay people more and more and more so that you have people upwards of $5, $6, $7 million getting paid that much.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm no expert on the UW-Madison athletic department, but I do remember, 20 years ago when UW-Madison just had a bunch of losing sports teams, and way back then, Donna Shalala, the chancellor, did recruit Barry Alvarez, and oh boy, then we went to the Rose Bowl, and then we were winners, and then the stadium was packed, and then there was all sorts of, you know, ads, PR type things, you know, come to UW-Madison. And it looked like there was, you know, everybody was happy and the university glowed a little bit, even more. UW-Madison has always had a good academic or a fairly good academic reputation, and it hasn't necessarily gone down the tubes. Is there nothing to be said about, getting a good coach and having a winning football or basketball team?
That's fine, but you don't have to pay them $3, $4, $2, $1 million a year to do that, do you? I mean, you don't have to, but I asked that question rhetorically. Actually, it seems that you do in the Star Wars arms race. I tell my students at the beginning of my sports sociology courses, I say, look, we will look at sports with a critical eye, but don't think that means I hate sports. I don't hate sports. I don't hold anything against a coach who's trying to make a career and make as much money. It's the American way. But I think there are people who are supposed to be responsible about putting this in perspective, and it's just not happening. And it hasn't happened for a long time, and it takes a lot of courage to try to turn it around. And it does happen once in a while. Nancy Zimfer was the president at University of Cincinnati, and they had a kind of wayward basketball coach. He was very, very successful, but he was getting into trouble from time to time. And the board, recognizing its responsibility, brought her in and said, you know, you need to turn this around. You need to clean this up. And so she did. She came in, and she got her hate mail for doing this, but she ultimately gave an ultimatum to the coach. He didn't meet the terms, and so he was fired. It happens. Miles Brand at Indiana University was dealing with Bobby Knight, who, he had these outbursts. He's notorious for the outbursts, but he's also very successful and very beloved in the state of Indiana, which loves its basketball, but finally was fired. He's getting death threats. There's something very, very perverse about that, I think. And, and you say, well, they're hoisted on their own petard that they let it happen. It's the combination of trustees and presidents, institutional leaders, efforts that allows this to happen. And we have the most perverse, of course, case, of course, and people say, well, this isn't really about athletics. It's about this very deviant personality who just happened to be involved in athletics at Penn State, Jerry Sandusky. Mm-hmm. The reason that spun out of control, and where he was not monitored more closely, where they didn't, the university didn't put a stop to the abuse that he was engaged in, is because they have what I call in the book a culture of reverence on that campus. Football was king. Joe Paterno was the king of the gang, and Joe. I don't know what was in his head, and we'll never know. But it appears from the evidence and that he had some knowledge of this. And, you know, they were concerned more about protecting Jerry Sandusky than they were the real victims of the abuse.
Right.
The president went, the story is that the president went to Joe Paterno and wanted him to take control of things. And, you know, they basically all agreed to kind of look the other way. And we know what happened. I mean, there's a free report about, Louis, free report about all this.
We need to take a short break. And we have other callers who now do want to weigh in on our discussion about what our guest calls the athletic trap. How college sports corrupted the academy. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network, talking this hour with Howard Nixon, author of The Athletic Trap, How College Sports Corrupted the Academy. And our next caller is Lydia in Cumberland. Hello, Lydia.
Good morning. Great topic. I've had to think quite a lot about this topic. I have kids in sports, and it was a real shock to me to realize that the coaches were less interested in forwarding their love of the game than they were in, you know, picking the heroes. And I've come to the conclusion that sports is a sort of show of power for the institution, whether it's a high school, and this is rampant in the high schools too, in the colleges, in the cities for the professional sports. It's and I guess the question would be, what kind of value do you put on this show of power and this sense of identity that's perceived but isn't necessarily a real value or benefit?
Mm-hmm. What's your reaction to that, Howard Nixon?
I think you put your finger on something very important. You know, why do institutions do that? Well, yeah, you could say it's about the money. And actually, for the partners in the Golden Triangle, it's about the money. But it's about institutional prestige and power. Yes, you're right. And I think that, you know, it's about this branding process. Institutions are interested in marketing themselves. And you're right, it's not just at the college level. It's at the high school levels, too. We see colleges building, huge stadia. Well, we see high schools sometimes building huge stadia. We see the high schools recruiting against each other, especially some of these private high schools. But even public high schools will try to get athletes from across state district lines into their programs, and you know they kind of lose sight entirely of what athletics is supposed to be about. And you know it's interesting. I had a parent one time take a course of mine. And she said, you know, I know nothing about athletics. And I said, well, this is a good course to take. She said, but I really feel responsible for my children. I want to know, because they seem to have an interest in athletics, what kind of world they're going to be entering. And the picture isn't pretty. And I don't mean to malign everyone. And there are many fine people in athletics, as I've said before. But the system, and in fact, it's a book about college football now called The System. The system works in ways that undermine the opportunities of kids to become, to love their sports, to play for the love of sports. Once you become part of this enterprise of athletics, then you have lost control over it yourself. I mean, it's not your life to live. Your welfare isn't the primary concern.
Yeah, I wanted to briefly follow up on what we talked a little bit about in our first half hour, but not only are these kids perhaps not learning the love of the sport, but they're not really learning. I'm looking at a CNN investigation of the grades of college athletes, and it shows a large proportion are reading like fifth graders, if that. So it's they're not getting the education that they deserve.
That's true, and you know I want to make a state very clearly though, there are many student athletes who are genuine student athletes in non-commercialized programs, especially women, who do quite well academically. But yeah, I mean I think there are two things going on in these big time programs. Number one, because of the need to have great athletes to be successful, we cut corners. We allow underqualified students to go to college. I mean, some of them really are have a very difficult time adjusting because they're not really ready for college. And then we have ways to facilitate their staying eligible, and sometimes that involves illegal behavior.
Yeah, let me bring in another caller, Stanley in Augusta. Hi, Stanley.
Hello. I was you had mentioned when Chancellor Shalala had hired Barry Alvarez, and I was a student at that time, and it has left a sour taste in me towards athletics on the university level, and it has carried over toward my attitude towards athletics in our high school. They added a $50 a semester. It was probably a segregated fee, and I have just always resented that they had to take money from students to support the athletic program rather than supporting academics. And in addition, all that money went to football, basketball, the premier sports, and they cut the sports that were still amateur, baseball, the rowing team, I assume other programs. Those were the two I remember from the newspaper articles.
And because we have very short on time, you touched on this. That's part of the athletic trap, Howard.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is because they need the money to make the sustain these programs, and they don't have it at most institutions without that. And the question is, of course, what does this have to do? I always ask the question, how does any of this improve the education of a student on campus? I think that you have to really struggle to find an answer.
Yeah. Well, in our final minute, what do you think the future is going to bring when it comes to big-time college athletics?
Well, I think that some of the things that I'm proposing that seem so radical are actually happening. I mean, I think there is a virtual partitioning of college sports. The NCAA has virtually lost control of the big-time football programs as the super conferences have taken over. I don't know where this arms race is going to go. People keep saying it's financially unsustainable. At some point, these institutions are going to have to fall out of the competition. But it's going to be hard to change all this. But there have to be voices in the wilderness. And I'm not the only one, by the way. I mean, there are people like Joe Nocera, New York Times, Taylor Branch, the historian, and others who've been calling for change. And you're reading more about this. So, and plus, the law may take over, and we may have this kind of this asteroid theory come to play where things come out of the blue and change things, and lawsuit could do that.
We'll see what happens. Thank you so much for being with us. Howard Nixon is the author of The Athletic Trap. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.